Welcome to Let's Talk FCA, presented by Kroll & Mooring. We're your co-hosts, Jason Crawford and Mona Lombardo, bringing you the latest developments with the False Claims Act. Today we're joined by special guests, Laura Cordova and Will Chang. Laura and Will are both partners in Kroll's healthcare and white-collar and regulatory enforcement groups. Prior to joining Kroll, Laura served as assistant chief in the fraud section of the criminal division at the United States Department of Justice, where she created and led the Corporate Healthcare Fraud Strike Force, charged with investigating and prosecuting large, multi-jurisdictional fraud schemes throughout the United States. And due to popular demand, we've also brought back Will Chang as a special guest. Prior to joining Kroll, Will worked at the fraud section of the criminal division, where he was a founding member of the Corporate Healthcare Fraud Strike Force. Welcome, Will and Laura.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to be back.
Thanks, Mona. And we've invited Will and Laura to today's podcast to discuss how recent Department of Justice policy developments could affect the way that FCA cases are investigated, litigated, and ultimately resolved. We're going to be focusing on a speech that Acting Associate Attorney General Jesse Panuccio gave last month at the ABA's False Claims Act Institute here in D.C., where he discussed various FCA reform initiatives. Will, can you start us off by describing what Mr. Panuccio had to say on the topic of cooperation credit?
Absolutely. Mr. Panuccio recognized that the department needed to reform, in several different respects, the way it was enforcing the False Claims Act. And an integral part of those reform projects involved the way the department would handle cooperation credit and credit for a strong compliance program. One of the main problems that Mr. Panuccio identified is that there was a lack of transparency and predictability for those on the other side of these actions. I think what he said was, those policies are now found scattered throughout numerous memoranda and internal guidance issued by various DOJ components. The Department of Justice was in the process of formalizing all those different documents into one policy with the help of stakeholders both within and outside the DOJ.
So why do you think this is important for our listening audience?
Well, a couple of reasons. On the front end, a company, when deciding how much to invest into a compliance program, which makes full cooperation possible, they need to know what they can expect in returns on that investment. In the criminal corporate context, that has been much clearer starting back in 2016 with the FCPA pilot program, which has been expanded and formalized now to other corporate crimes. And there's also resources found in the United States Attorney's Manual and United States Sentencing Guidelines. But that type of predictability on returns did not really exist in the False Claims Act space. So that's number one. Number two, exactly what is cooperation? From the Department of Justice's perspective, exactly what is compliance? Jesse Panuccio recognized that those also needed to be better defined, more predictable, and more transparent. And I think his speech really gives companies, even right now, before those policies are released, a good indicator of what those two terms will mean. Because he borrows many of the phrases that also accompanied the rollout of similar policy initiatives in the criminal corporate context. And so there are already sources that he's pointing us toward.
So, Will, would you say that this is a change from the department's approach in the past? And if so, how do you think it's going to impact the way that companies approach FCA investigations and settlement discussions?
So I see it less as a change, as more of a logical and natural extension of what we've been seeing at the Department of Justice and how it handles corporate malfeasance. Let's take a step back to 2016 with the launch of the FCPA pilot program. And then we fast forward a year, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in a speech recognized that after the FCPA pilot program was launched, there's almost a doubling of voluntary self-disclosures from private industry, right? And that's really the point of these programs. It's a recognition that the Department of Justice by itself is not going to be as nearly effective as a situation where it is partnered up with private industry to identify and stop corporate malfeasance on the front end. And there's also a reality here that the numbers bear out. The False Claims Act was created to stem and to combat fraud against the government. In the healthcare space alone, the estimates is that anywhere from $65 billion to over $100 billion is lost each year to improper payments by Medicare. That's just by Medicare. Now, if we take the larger bucket of improper government payments that's lost to fraud, that includes things by the Department of Defense, state healthcare programs, et cetera, that's a large bucket. Even in the best year of FCA recovery, it's still less than $4 billion per year. The bottom line is this. Just relying on affirmative FCA enforcement by DOJ efforts alone is just a drop in the bucket. They need to do more to stem the tide of this fraud. And the Department of Justice is sending the signal. We're doing this by creating much clearer and greater incentives for strong compliance and cooperation.
Thanks, Will. Laura, Will mentioned the FCPA pilot program. What other lessons do you think we can learn from the criminal context when thinking about how cooperation credit might be applied in cases brought under the civil FCA?
I think Will touched on it, which is that cooperation can be incredibly valuable to companies. Cooperation credit can be incredibly valuable. And what we've seen in the criminal context is that DOJ is going to try very hard to demonstrate that value to companies. So companies will do what DOJ thinks is the right thing, which is to investigate and disclose wrongdoing by individuals that work for the company. And so what that means in a practical sense is that you're going to see, as Will mentioned a moment ago, you're going to see this conversation in the FCA context happen much earlier about what do we need to do right now? We just got a whistleblower. We just got a CID. We just got some information that's telling us that we need to investigate. What are we going to do to make sure that we're in the best position to demonstrate to DOJ that we have fully cooperated? And what we've seen in the criminal context and what we're now seeing also in the civil context in FCA investigation is that both DOJ's investigation and the internal investigation are going to focus much more quickly, much sooner in the process, they're going to focus on individuals. And the reality is that has a very disruptive impact on companies. At least that's what I've observed, because once that happens and the focus is on individuals, more individuals in the FCA context might need attorneys much sooner than they normally would. If you go back several years, it was rather rare for people in FCA context to get their own attorneys because the expectation was that the company would do the investigation, the company would reach a settlement with DOJ, and individuals probably wouldn't be in the crosshairs as much, and certainly not low-level individuals. But that's not the case anymore. DOJ is focusing on it right away in response to the Yates memo, and certainly this administration has demonstrated that they care a lot about holding individuals accountable. And so that's the practical impact, is that the focus on individuals, which is necessary for a company to get any cooperation credit, is just going to be a bigger deal sooner in the investigations.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Pannuccio stressed that very point when he talked about what constitutes cooperation credit in his speech. And last year with eClinical Works, it was a $155 million settlement, but also that settlement involved the CEO, chief medical officer, and chief operating officer also being jointly severally liable for $155 million. And as Laura just mentioned, it wasn't just the top executives. It also included developers and project managers. They were hit with $15,000.
So let me bounce off of that as you guys are discussing the impact on the companies. In his speech, Mr. Pannuccio also discussed compliance program credit. Laura, should the department's approach to compliance credit influence the ways that companies approach their compliance measures?
Yes, that's been clear now for a couple years that DOJ is focusing on compliance more so than it ever did before. This started when Will and I were at DOJ in the criminal fraud section several years ago. And just last year, the criminal fraud section released the Evaluation of Corporate Compliance Programs guidance. And this lays out very nicely many of the factors that DOJ is going to be considering. And companies need to take a hard look at that and make sure that they have a good story to tell on all of these factors and are taking these into account with their programs. And the other thing I'll say is, given this focus and the new administration, both the Attorney General and others at DOJ have emphasized the importance that they place on compliance programs in corporate America. So this isn't something, even though it started in the last administration, this is certainly something that's continuing to receive high priority from DOJ. With all of that, I think that you're going to see a couple of things. DOJ attorneys are becoming more sophisticated at analyzing compliance programs. Whereas several years ago, certainly when I started as a prosecutor, I didn't really know where to start in terms of evaluating, is this a good compliance program? Is it a bad compliance program? And I certainly was not alone in that lack of knowledge. But the focus that DOJ has been placing on it is really increasing that knowledge and expertise within the prosecutors and the supervisors at DOJ. So it's becoming clear that just having a paper program, having great policies and procedures is not enough. DOJ is going to really be looking at the resources that are devoted to compliance and the autonomy or ability of the compliance program to actually take action and have an impact. Those are two things that are going to be really important to DOJ, because that tells DOJ not just we created this nice paper program, but the company actually takes this seriously. And the other thing I will say that is really important, and particularly I'll use a healthcare example, because the thing that's important is to focus on high risk areas. DOJ is going to want to know, for example, if you're a pharmaceutical company, is your compliance program focusing on the high risk areas? Payments to physicians, payments to other providers. What does your marketing program look like? How involved is compliance in monitoring the marketing programs? Those are the sorts of things that whatever area you're in, you need to be keeping an eye on what DOJ is focusing on, because that will help you identify your risk areas. But then also doing a risk assessment yourself to identify what are our risk areas, even if there isn't a DOJ press release on this issue. That's what DOJ is going to be asking down the road if you're ever in front of them, is what were you doing at the time? How were you focusing your resources? Another aspect of compliance that's critically important when you're talking to DOJ is remediation and what happened when the company learned of the conduct that's at issue or similar conduct in the past. What remediation did the company take?
And Laura, the Deputy Attorney General emphasized that very point in his speech last year. He said, and then Mr. Panuccio echoed again, even at companies with the best compliance programs, things will go wrong, especially with companies as large and diffuse as many of the public companies are today. Mr. Rosenstein even said the same thing is true of the Department of Justice. And the two questions that he raised is, when things go wrong, the department will ask two overarching questions. What was the state of the compliance program at the time of the improper conduct? And two, and this was your point, what is the current state of the compliance function after remediation to address any lessons learned? The idea is this: compliance has to be a living, dynamic system. It can't be created, then shelved, and expected to run on autopilot.
When discussing the policy initiatives that are currently underway, the Acting Associate Attorney General also mentioned the department's authority to dismiss meritless cases. This issue has been one of the hotter issues in 2018, ever since the so-called Granston Memo was released earlier this year. Mon and I discussed the Granston Memo in our very first podcast, but since then there have been some opportunities to see how the policy change has looked in action. Will, can you give us a sense of how courts have come out in cases where this has been litigated?
Sure. Since the Granston Memo was issued in January of 2018, I think an open question from those of us who have been watching these developments is whether it would actually have teeth. And while there hasn't been enough decisions yet for me to sit here and tell you that there's a trend, two district court decisions that were issued earlier suggest that the message is being taken seriously at Maine Justice and at the United States Attorney's offices. The decisions, one was out of California, and the one that was out of Kentucky, where the Department of Justice moved for Granston dismissals for many of the reasons articulated in the Granston memo. Interestingly there, those decisions came out in two different ways, even though the Department of Justice took the same stance in each. In the Kentucky case called Maldonado, the district court ruled that the Department of Justice had virtually unfettered discretion to dismiss QTAMs under the FCA. Whereas in Academy Mortgage, the California District Court denied Department of Justice's motion to dismiss explaining that the Department of Justice had conducted an insufficient investigation, which, according to the department's brief, represents the first time a federal court has denied such a motion to dismiss. So we'll be following these developments and reporting on them. But so far, it seems that the Granson memo is, there are some teeth behind it.
Thanks, Will, for that analysis. You know, Mr. Panuccio also touched upon the need to prevent piling on. Laura, can you explain to us what that policy position means and what it means for FCA defendants?
Sure. I think this is a good policy. I think it makes a lot of sense. And once again, it's a continuation of a policy that we've seen implemented, particularly in the FCPA context, the criminal context. In the FCA context, it's very often the case that civil DOJ is not the only group of prosecutors or investigators involved. And so I'll use an example from the healthcare context. You'll likely have HHS, OIG involved, civil DOJ, and you might also have criminal DOJ involved. So you have basically three different sets of people that you're dealing with to try to reach a resolution. And so whereas in the FCPA context, this was born out of the idea that you have maybe several countries involved in a resolution. And so if everybody imposes their full penalty, then the company is really paying multiple times for the same wrongdoing. But the same can be true here in a domestic case where you have an OIG, civil, and criminal. Each one of those has their own penalties that they can assign. And then obviously there's just the underlying, let's say it's an overbilling case, the amount that was overbilled is going to go back. But then on top of that, you've got fines and penalties from each of those entities. So what DOJ has said is basically, we're going to take a close look at that, and we're going to take that into consideration when we're reaching our resolution. So this would cover both the civil and the criminal prosecutors at DOJ. And one thing that's really interesting is in the U.S. Attorney's Manual, it specifically says that in determining the coordination and apportionment of the resolution, DOJ will consider adequacy and timeliness of a company's disclosures and its cooperation with the department, that's the Department of Justice, separate from any such disclosures and cooperation with other relevant enforcement entities. The way I read this is that, once again, DOJ is seeking to encourage disclosure to DOJ and seeking to create an obvious benefit to such disclosure. In the healthcare context, before this policy came out, one might decide to disclose to the Medicare contractor, and then the next step would be to OIG, but then maybe not disclose to DOJ. You don't have an obligation to do that, but this is creating an incentive to do that because DOJ is specifically saying that they're going to be considering the disclosure to DOJ in determining the proper apportionment of fines and penalties under the piling on policy.
Well, if we were going to wrap this up, what should the listening audience expect going forward in connection with the initiatives discussed in Mr. Panuccio's speech? And specifically, Will, do you think the department will be formalizing the reform policies?
Yes, Mr. Panuccio said in his speech that the department is in the process of formalizing these reform measures, and that involves the compliance and cooperation credit that we have been discussing. And importantly, Mr. Panuccio also said that this process will involve the input of stakeholders both within the department and outside the department. If we go back to February, this is a month after the Granson memo was released, you can see that in the speeches, the department is recognizing that meritless FCA enforcement action is exacting a toll, not just for the department, but also for defendants. This theme was repeated at least twice by the Department of Justice. And now the Department of Justice is soliciting input from stakeholders outside of the department as well. His speech is very encouraging for the private industry to, one, show the industry the Department of Justice recognizes the toll meritless FCA actions exact on them. Two, a recognition that even the best companies will have wrongdoing that is not preventable. And three, the department wants their input as they formalize these reforms.
So in closing, Will and Laura, if anyone listening has follow-up questions for you, what's the best way to contact you?
You can reach me at email lcordova@kroll.com, or my phone number is 202-624-2931.
And you could reach me at wchang@crow.com. My number is 202-624-2730.
Thank you. Well, that's all for this episode. I want to thank you both, Laura and Will, for joining us today and sharing your thoughts on recent FCA policy developments. We plan on following these developments closely in the coming months. And in the meantime, if you have any questions, Mona can be reached at 213-443-5563 and Jason at 202-624-2562. We'll see you next time.
Let's Talk FCA is brought to you by Kroll & Mooring LLP. You can find more information at kroll.com/podcasts.